Part 1. Chapter 1. Just before dusk, in the late afternoon of June 16th, 1832, I found myself walking along the crowded docks of Liverpool, England, following a man by the name of Grummidge. Though a business associate of my father, Mr. Grummidge was, like my father, a gentleman. It was he my father delegated to make the final arrangements for my passage to America. He was also to meet me when I came down from school on the coach, then see me safely stowed aboard the ship that my father had previously selected. Mr. Grummidge was dressed in a black frock coat with a stovepipe hat that added to his considerable height. His somber, sallow face registered no emotion. His eyes might have been those of a dead fish. "Miss Doyle," he said as I stepped from the Liverpool coach. "Yes, sir. Are you Mr. Grummidge?" "I am." "Pleased to meet you," I said, dipping a curtsy. "Quite," he returned. "Now, Miss Doyle, if you would be so good as to indicate which is your trunk, I have a man here to carry it. Next, please oblige me by following, and everything shall be as it is meant to be." "Might I say goodbye to my chaperone?" "Is that necessary?" "She's been very kind." "Make haste, then." In a flutter of nervousness, I identified my trunk, threw my arms about Miss Emerson, my sweet companion for the trip down, and bid her a tearful farewell. Then I rushed after Mr. Grummidge, who had already begun to move on. A rough-looking porter, laboring behind, carried my trunk upon his back. Our little parade reached dockside in good order. There I became instantly agog at the mass of ships that lay before us, masts and spars thick as the bristles on a brush. Everywhere I looked I saw mountains of rare goods piled high, bales of silk and tobacco, chests of tea, a parrot, a monkey. Oh, yes, the smell of the sea was intoxicating to one who knew little more than the smell of the trim-cut lawns and the fields of the Barrington School. Then, too, the surging crowds of workers, sailors, and merchants, all rough-hewn, brawny men, created an exotic late-afternoon hubbub. All in all, it was a most delicious chaos, which, while mildly menacing, was no less exciting because of that. Indeed, in some vague way, I had the feeling that it was all there for me. "Mr. Grummidge, sir," I called over the din, "what is the name of the ship I'm to sail on?" Mr. Grummidge paused briefly to look at me as though surprised I was there, to say nothing of asking a question. Then from one of his pockets he drew a screw of paper. Squinting at it, he pronounced, "The Seahawk." "Is she British or American?"
"American."
"A merchant ship?"
"To be sure."
"How many masts?"
"I don't know."
"Will the other families already be on board?"
"I should think so," he answered, exasperation in his voice. "For your information, Miss Doyle, I received word that departure was being put off, but when I checked with the captain directly, he informed me that there must have been some misunderstanding. The ship is scheduled to leave with the first tide tomorrow morning, so there can be no delay." To prove the point, he turned to move again. I, however, unable to quell my excited curiosity, managed to slip in one more question.
"Mr. Grummidge, sir, what is the captain's name?"
Mr. Grummidge stopped again, frowning in an irritated fashion, but all the same consulted his paper. "Captain Jaggery," he announced, and once more turned to go.
"Here!"
the porter exclaimed suddenly. He had come up close and overheard our talk. Both Mr. Grummidge and I looked about.
"Did you say Captain Jaggery?"
the porter demanded.
"Are you addressing me?"
Mr. Grummidge inquired, making it perfectly clear that if so, the porter had committed a serious breach of decorum.
"I was," the man said, talking over my head. "And I'm asking if I heard right when you said we was going to a ship mastered by a certain Captain Jaggery."
He spoke the name Jaggery as if it were something positively loathsome.
"I was not addressing you," Mr. Grummidge informed the man. "But I hears you all the same," the porter went on.
And so saying, he swung my trunk down upon the dock with such a ferocious crack
that I feared it would snap in two. I don't intend to take one more step toward anything to do with a Mr. Jaggery. Not for double gold. Not one more step.
See here, Mr. Grummidge cried with indignation. You undertook...
Never mind what I undertook, the man retorted. It's worth more to me to avoid that man than to close with your coin.
And without another word, he marched off.
Stop! I say, stop! Mr. Grummidge called.
It was in vain. The porter had gone, and quickly at that. Mr. Grummidge and I looked at each other. I hardly knew what to make of it, nor clearly did he. Yet he did what he had to do. He surveyed the area in search of a replacement.
There, you man,
he cried to the first who passed by, a huge laboring fellow in a smock.
Here's a shilling if you can carry this young lady's trunk.
The man paused, looked at Mr. Grummidge, at me, at the trunk.
That?
He asked disdainfully. I'll be happy to add a second shilling, I volunteered, thinking that a low offer was the problem.
Miss Doyle, Mr. Grummidge snapped, let me handle this.
2 shillings, the workman said quickly.
1, Mr. Grummidge countered.
2,
the workman repeated, and held his hand out to Mr. Grummidge, who gave him but 1 coin. Then the man turned and extended his hand to me. Hastily, I began to extract a coin from my reticule.
Miss Doyle, Mr. Grummidge objected.
I did promise, I whispered, and dropped the coin into the man's upturned palm.
Right you are, miss, said the porter with a tip of his hat. May the whole world follow your fashion.
This commendation of my principles of moral goodness brought a blush of pleasure that I could hardly suppress. As for Mr. Grummidge, he made a point of clearing his throat to indicate disapproval.
Now then, the porter asked, where does the young lady require this?
Never mind where, Mr. Grummidge snapped. Along the docks here. I'll tell you when we arrive.
The money pocketed, the man lumbered over to my trunk, swung it to his shoulder with astonishing ease, considering the trunk's weight and size, and said,
lead on.
Mr. Grummidge, wasting no more time, and perhaps fearful of the consequence of more talk, started off again. After guiding us through a maze of docks and quays, he came to a stop. With a half turn, he announced,
there she sits,
and gestured to a ship moored to the slip before us. I had hardly looked where he pointed when I heard a thump behind. Startled, I turned and saw that the new man, the one we'd just engaged, had taken 1 look at the Seahawk, set down my trunk in haste, and, like the first, run off without any word of explanation at all. Mr. Grummidge barely glanced over his shoulder at the hastily departing worker. In exasperation, he said, Miss Doyle, you will wait for me here. And with rapid strides, he took himself up the gangplank and onto the Seahawk, where he disappeared from my view. I stood my place, more than ever wanting to get aboard and meet the delightful children who would be my traveling companions. But as I waited on the dock for something like 30 minutes, all but unmoving in the waning light of day, I could only gaze upon the ship. To say that I was unduly alarmed when I examined the Seahawk would be nonsense. I had not the remotest superstitious notion of what was to come. Nothing of the kind. No, the Seahawk was a ship like countless others I had seen before, or for that matter have seen since. Oh, perhaps she was smaller and older than I had anticipated, but nothing else. Moored to the dock, she rode the swell easily. Her standard rigging, tarred black for protection against the salt sea, rose above me, dark ladders to an increasingly dark sky, and indeed her royal yard seemed lost in the lowering night. Her sails tied up, that is, reefed, looked like sleeves of new-fallen snow on lofty trees. Briefly, the Seahawk was what is known as a brig, a 2-masted ship, with a snowmast behind the main, perhaps some 700 tons in weight, 107 feet stern to bow, 130 feet deck to mainmast cap. She was built, perhaps, in the late 18th or early 19th century. Her hull was painted black, her bulwarks white, these being the ordinary colors. Her 2 masts, raked slightly back, were square-rigged,
She had a bowsprit, too, one that stood out from her bow like a unicorn's horn. Indeed, the one unique aspect of this ship was a carved figurehead of a pale white seahawk beneath the bowsprit. Its wings were thrust back against the bow, its head extended forward, beak wide open, red tongue protruding as if screaming. In the shadowy light that twisted and distorted its features, I was struck by the notion that this figure looked more like an angry, avenging angel than a docile bird. The dockside was deserted and growing darker. I felt like taking myself up the gangplank in search of Mr. Grummidge. But, alas, my good manners prevailed. I remained where I was, standing in a dreamlike state, thinking I know not what. But gradually, like a telescope being focused, I began to realize I was watching something clinging to one of the mooring ropes on the ship's stern. It reminded me of a picture I once had seen of a sloth, an animal that hangs upside down upon jungle vines. But this, I gradually perceived, was a man. He appeared to be shimmying himself from the dock up to the Seahawk. Even as I realized what I was seeing, he boarded the ship and was gone. I had no time to absorb that vision before I heard angry voices. Turning, I saw Mr. Grummidge appear at the topgallant rail, engaged in an argument with someone I could not see. My gentleman repeatedly looked down at me and, so I thought, gesticulated in my direction as if I were the subject of a heated discussion. At last, Mr. Grummidge came down to the dock. As he drew near, I saw that his face was flushed with an angry eye that alarmed me. "Is something amiss?" I asked in a whisper.
"Not at all," he snapped. "All is as planned. You've been expected. The ship's cargo is loaded. The captain is ready to sail. But..."
He trailed off, looked back at the ship, then turned again to me.
"It's just that... You see, those two families, the ones you would be traveling with, your companions, they have not arrived."
"But they will?" I said, trying to compose myself.
"That's not entirely certain," Mr. Grummidge allowed. "The second mate informs me that one family sent word that they could not reach Liverpool in time. The other family has a seriously ill child. There is concern that she should not be moved."
Again Mr. Grummidge glanced over his shoulder at the Seahawk, as if, in some fashion, these events were the ship's fault. Turning back to me, he continued,
"As it stands, Captain Jaggery will accept no delay of departure. Quite proper, he has his orders."
"But Mr. Grummidge, sir," I asked in dismay, "what shall I do?"
"Do? Miss Doyle, your father left orders that you were to travel on this ship at this time. I have very specific written orders in that regard. He left no money to arrange otherwise. As for myself," he said, "I'm off for Scotland tonight on pressing business."
"But surely," I cried, frustrated by the way Mr. Grummidge was talking as much as by his news, "surely I mustn't travel alone."
"Miss Doyle," he returned, "being upon a ship with the full complement of captain and crew could hardly be construed as traveling alone."
But that would be all men, Mr. Grummidge, and
I am a girl. It would be wrong,"
I cried in absolute confidence that I was echoing the beliefs of my beloved parents. Mr. Grummidge drew himself up.
"Miss Doyle," he said loftily, "in my world, judgments as to rights and wrongs are left to my Creator, not to children. Now be so good as to board the Seahawk at once."